Thank you very much for tuning in. You're listening to Your Turn, the program I've dubbed Meeting Nonsense with Common Sense. And my name is Renee Giacchino, and I'm corporate counsel for the Center for Individual Freedom. Please visit our website at www.cfif.org, where you can sign up for our free Lunchtime Liberty Update. It appears every Friday in your mailbox, in your email box, and we'll include in there some topics of interest from the week, some notable quotables. We've got our courtroom jester, which lines up for you some outrageous and bizarre things that are happening in our legal system, and we're going to talk a lot more about that this next half hour when we talk with Judge Robert Durker. He's the author of a new book recently released just out less than a month. It's called The Tyranny of Tolerance, with the subtitle A Sitting Judge Breaks the Code of Silence to Expose the Liberal Judicial Assault. Welcome very much to Your Turn, Judge Durker. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, it's a very interesting book. When I started to read the book, I wasn't quite sure exactly where, you know, the code of silence was going to be broken, but it starts very early in the book when you are laying out for folks, for the readers, how it is that our judicial system has been changed, how it has evolved over the years from one that, you know, really offered some balance to our legal system, or under the Constitution, it was our third tripartite system, and now it's become something that's much different from that. It's upset the balance of power, and you make that known very early in the book, I think on page 3. If you would please describe how you think the court has changed over time, you know, even say in the last 15 years.
The book attempts to give, as you noted, kind of a panoramic view of what's going on, and particularly from a perspective that most people, I don't think, get, somebody in the trenches. And, you know, I think that what has happened is there's a philosophy that has taken hold in the courts, in the legal profession. I call it a more equal than others philosophy that basically holds that the judiciary can and should promote the interests of selected groups at the expense of the Constitution itself. And in promoting that, it also holds that the courts really have no limits to their power. And I think in the last 15 or 20 years, we've seen dramatic examples of that with court orders for imposing taxes, court orders intruding on the conduct of the war, on terror, court orders approving what they call, some judges call, benign discrimination in the face of the plain meaning of the Equal Protection Clause. And it's a process that I think began quite a while ago, as far back as the New Deal, but I think it has mutated in a way that has made the third branch the most dangerous branch of government.
Well, really, I think what the book lays out, and you give example after example of this, is how the critical decision-making that we look to the legislature to do has in some way been thwarted, and now that may lie, in fact, with the courts and from some of our perspective, worse yet, with the liberal judges who happen to be on the bench in those courts. Is that an accurate description?
Very much so. I think that we do, with this philosophy and the way it's being implemented, the power of the people to decide questions of social policy, taxation, war making, educational funding, those issues are being stripped away from the people and arrogated to the judiciary. You know, I certainly focus to a large degree on the U.S. Supreme Court because this is very much of a top-down arrangement. But on the other hand, I think that what I attempted to get across is that this hasn't just been confined to five judges inside the Beltway. This is a philosophy that has now spread and is being embraced by judges at all levels. And I think that is what's so alarming about it.
In Chapter 1, it's called The Cloud Cuckoo Land of Radical Feminism. You indicate that perhaps if you had not had your very own direct run-in with the term that you use, the tyrants of tolerance, you may not have, I don't want to say had the wherewithal, but had the gumption, I guess, would, for lack of a better word, to sit down and write this book. Now, certainly, it's only been out less than a month, but it has received a lot of press, some of it very favorable and some of it criticizing you for doing exactly what you say in the title of the book, and that is breaking the code of silence to expose the liberal judicial assault. Do you have any regrets?
Of course, it's always a little bit stressful when people want you fired for writing something. And as the first chapter indicates, you know, I started thinking about this problem because somebody wanted me disciplined for writing using strong language in an opinion about sexual harassment law. And I began to collect research and materials on what I saw as an issue. The code of silence that's referred to in the subtitle is really more an intimidation thing than the judicial code of conduct, which encourages judges to write and speak about the law and the legal process and doesn't tell us that we have to submit these things to a board of censors. In fact, it tells us that we're in a unique position because of our unique perspective to contribute to understanding. And so now, of course, I've written this book, and the same people who didn't like the opinion I wrote several years ago now want me disciplined for writing the book. And yet it's this philosophy that I keep talking about is something that tolerates no dissent. And that's why, hence the title, Tyranny of Tolerance. There's no room for debate or disagreement about some of these issues when people are claiming to act in the name of equality or tolerance. They tolerate no disagreement.
Worse yet, it seems there's no room for the First Amendment.
Exactly. I think this is another facet where the courts have been pressed into service to exercise powers that don't belong to them. And the other side of the coin is that the courts are simply ignoring provisions of the Constitution that the people with this philosophy don't want enforced, among them the First Amendment. And you know, my own experience was so alarming to me that I thought, what's going on here? If the judiciary, if the judges can be intimidated from writing opinions, you know, what is causing this? And that's a large part of the book, is this philosophy that some are more equal than others, and nobody is allowed to debate the issue.
Well, the issue of debating it, you know, without revealing too much of the inner sanction, inner circle of you know, the robes, the judges' robes. How much of this gets talked about? I mean, you get together at conferences. You may get together socially as well. Is this something that the judicial community is talking about? Is this something they've been talking about? And just no one's been brave enough to step forward and say, okay, listen, we need to begin to swing the pendulum back in the other direction, or who knows where we're going to end up?
I think that it is discussed among the judges. I think the reaction that I got to this book is indicative of why many judges feel reluctant to speak out. You know, we recognize what's going on, and many of us are very concerned that it's forcing us to into an arena where we don't belong. And yet we, you know, certainly I as a trial judge, you know, I have to follow the dictates of the higher courts, and I try to make clear in the book that while I may disagree strongly with some of the rules that have been laid down, you know, it's my obligation if I'm on the bench, which I'm not now, I'm off the clock, and you don't have to call me judge, but you know, I have to do this, but we're very concerned about it. And I think there is debate within the judiciary, both about what's going on and how far people can go in talking about it.
When you say you're off the clock, I mean, you're still a sitting judge. You just mean you're not on the clock right now. The court is closed for the day. You're done. The same is true, I would assume, when you wrote the book. You were off the clock.
Precisely. I mean, I'm an author who happens to be a judge, and I'm talking about the book because I'm trying to get a message out that I think the people need to hear, and I hope, having looked at the message, whether they agree or disagree, they'll start paying attention, because in the final analysis, many of these decisions are being made for them. And whether I know many liberal judges who feel that there are limits to the judicial power, and yet they see the limits being stripped away one by one in the name of the Equal Protection Clause.
Setting aside, you know, John Roberts, Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts' comments and his hope that they will raise the pay for members of the judiciary, I've read recently that one of the criticisms out there is that you are benefiting financially from a book that you have written based on your experience as a sitting judge and you are still currently on the bench. Doesn't this happen all the time?
Judges have written books all the time. Justice Breyer has a book out. Judge Posner has many, many books out. Justice Scalia, Chief Justice Rehnquist. There were several state judges. One of the most famous years ago, Jerome Frank, very liberal judge, wrote a book called Courts on Trial, which had tremendous influence. You know, the idea is I want to get the message out. If I write a law review article, very few lawyers, if any, will even read it. So, you know, of course you try to get a trade publisher to publish it. And so it's kind of a, you know, it's a chicken and egg situation. I want to get the message out, and this is the best way. And, you know, so am I writing it to make a ton of money? Well, I haven't made a ton of money yet. This is, you know, I want to get this out and get this talked about.
When you say you want to get the message out, the book, The Tyranny of Tolerance, we know what the message is. The message is that it's not necessarily true that the system is equal for all. But what do we do about it? I mean, what is the bottom line that the average American citizen who cares about this issue, and we all should, what should we be doing about it? In a lot of places, you know, we don't have an opportunity to vote in our judges. We, frankly, very often don't even know what their position, you know, happens to be on certain issues. Beyond, you know, the situations where someone might have an opportunity to vote someone to be a sitting judge, what else can we do? Why, you know, how do we get involved?
That's a good question, and I try to lay out some things that can be done in the concluding chapter of the book. Basically, what can we do about it?
Right.
You know, the most basic thing we can do about it is what we have to do constantly in a democracy. You know, we have to pay attention and let the elected branches of government know that we demand a judiciary that stays within the constitutional bounds. And I illustrate how the people can have an impact by the reaction to the Connecticut eminent domain case, which has inspired activity all across the country to limit the power of eminent domain by legislative action. The legislatures have in many cases, in my own state of Missouri, they reacted. They have acted to limit the jurisdiction of the courts. I think that if the people demand this on a sustained basis with their elected officials, the elected officials are going to react to it. I think the Senator Daschle's experience in South Dakota, I think clearly the judiciary was a major issue in that campaign. If people, and this is more than, you know, I emphasize, I don't see it as a Republican-Democrat thing. This is a democracy thing. This is, if you demand that the judiciary stay within its proper bounds and let your legislators know that, and make sure that judges, the executive selects judges who have a philosophy that knows limits to the power of the judiciary. It's the thing that the people have to do, and I'm hopeful that if people pay attention and send the message, I think that message will be received.
And the case you're referring to, and we've talked about this on the program in the past, is the Kelo decision, and a lot of folks out there know that that's the eminent domain case where they're basically saying, you know, they can twist and turn what is meant by public use when they take someone's property.
Exactly.
And some legislatures have come behind the U.S. Supreme Court in this situation and said, you know what, we don't agree, we don't think that's what was intended, and so they have put into place laws that counter those situations. Most particularly, I know, you know, in some situations they tie it in with financial remuneration. They say we're not going to allow public funds to pay for any of these types of cases. An excellent example of what you write about in your book, The Tyranny of Tolerance, on how we can, in fact, begin to turn the tide and, as I said, swing the pendulum in the other direction. Joining us from St. Louis, Missouri, is Judge Robert Durker. He has put his career at risk. He's a sitting judge there in St. Louis, Missouri. He's on the 22nd Judicial Circuit of Missouri. And he put his career at risk to write a new book that just came out last month. It's called The Tyranny of Tolerance: A Sitting Judge Breaks the Code of Silence to Expose the Liberal Judicial Assault. It's a passionate, no-holds-barred expose of the left's radical war on the courts. And Tammy has a question for him. Go ahead, Tammy, it's your turn. And by the way, Tammy, it's nice to have you back. I haven't heard from you in a while.
Yes, you're welcome. Yes, the Constitution Party is the only party that I've seen that wants to take the lawmaking ability out of the court and put it back into the state legislatures. So even though the Republicans say they're against things, as long as they leave things in the court, they can say, oh, well, we can't help it. Those are the justices that are in there. But a true republic, your representatives of the state should be making the laws. And that's the only party I see that would change things.
Judge Durker, do you care to comment on her position?
I think she does touch on something that I mentioned in the book about when I talk about judges with a Republican philosophy, I don't use a capital R. I think there are people. Judges have to be selected with a view to recognizing the limits of judicial authority and recognizing the need to keep policymaking decisions within the legislative and the elected branch. She also, I think, implies an issue which I've seen repeatedly and I discuss in the book. You know, very often the elected officials are happy to shift the burden to the judges to make hard calls in certain issues. And I think the judges have to be alert not to let that ball be dumped in their court when it belongs in the lap of the other branches.
Well, you make an interesting point throughout the book. I mean, you raise several times that you took an oath of office to uphold the Constitution, as does each member of the legislature. So why is it that they feel they can shirk their duty and pass it over to the courts?
I think part of it, as I saw when I was practicing law and representing local government, you know, there's a certain, a fear factor. The elected officials sometimes are more than happy to let a decision be handed over to the courts. And I think there is a kind of a management by default mentality that takes hold in the judiciary that, well, somebody has to do it, and so we're going to take care of it. And so that happens. It's the nature of the political process. I think that's an area where the duty of the judges is to say, this is your call, and you've got to make it.
Okay. Tammy, any other comments?
Yeah, that's it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for calling in. We appreciate it. Judge Durker, I know that I think even probably before the ink dried on this book, there were some folks out there that were attacking you in the media, and they were attacking you as well with the Missouri bar. Obviously, as a proponent of the First Amendment, I'm against anything that requires people to not be able to talk about their situation, but I know that some bar associations and some of the disciplinary boards preclude people, the interested parties, from talking about a current situation. But to the extent that you can give us any information, what have you faced? What kind of attack have you been under?
It's been reported that a state senator filed a complaint seeking discipline against me, and my lawyers have reviewed the situation, and we feel confident that I'm not only within my First Amendment rights, but also abiding by the judicial canons of ethics, which in fact encourage judges to write about the book, or write about issues and publish books about legal issues. So I think the great weight of the objective opinion is that I am adhering to the rules, but there are people, in part, this is what the book is all about. I mean, I use certain phrases in the book, like femifascist, which provoked a lot of criticism, and I did that with some deliberation because I wanted to illustrate what's going on out there is that, you know, certain people with a certain philosophy, they want to suppress dissent, and, you know, I think people who want to suppress dissent are properly criticized for trying to censor speech, and that effort has been made. Whether it'll succeed or not remains to be seen.
Have you heard stories, and I'm sure you have, of judges who have been under similar attack? Certainly, like the attack that you lay out for the readers in the first chapter. You know, where you were attacked personally for a ruling that you issued. Does it drive folks away from the bench? I mean, I see that as a bigger problem that we may have down the road with our judiciary. I mean, why would anyone choose to put themselves under that kind of microscope, and why would you stay there?
I think that the intimidation factor, which I describe in the book, where you You're not allowed to speak about certain issues except in an approved way. I'm not sure if it deters people. You know, obviously judges try to kind of remain out of the spotlight, and with reason. I think that the worst effect of this is that sitting judges, in fact, are being intimidated, and they are afraid to speak out about certain issues that have been appropriated by what I call the tyranny of tolerance.
Okay, well, here's one judge who was not afraid to speak out. I think you'll enjoy his book. It's written by Judge Robert Durker. We've been talking with him about the tyranny of tolerance. A sitting judge breaks the code of silence to expose the liberal judicial assault. Thank you so much, Judge Durker, for joining us this afternoon, and we wish you much success with your book.
Thank you, Renee.